Welcome to Envision, the podcast to travel to new terrain into the world of possibilities, where conversations with visionaries, their experience and their imagination take place. We explore ideas and desires to widen individual vision and expand the collective together. Let's imagine a new world and speak it aloud, letting that vision become our inspiration to create it. If you're here, you believe in the power of transformation. I am Aurora Morfin, and I am so grateful that you're here. Let me introduce you.
All right.
Amy Jo Goddard is a renowned sexual empowerment educator and speaker who has been teaching sexuality and relationships for over 20 years. She earned her master's degree in human sexuality education from NYU, and she's the author of Woman on Fire and co-author of Lesbian Sex Secrets for Men. She's also the director for the forthcoming film At Your Service and host of her Fire Woman Retreat and other sexual empowerment programs that have helped thousands of people discover their sexuality and deepen their relationships and overall fulfillment. Thank you, Amy Jo, for being here.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here. This is exciting.
Thank you. So tell me, how was your world from your child's perspective?
I grew up moving a lot because my dad was in the military and I grew up with my dad. My mom left when I was 6 or 7. I sort of don't remember the exact timeline, but she left when I was in second grade. And so we actually grew up with my dad, and I have 2 siblings and I'm the oldest. So I think that family structure and being the oldest kid in my family, being the oldest girl, who when the mother had left the house really left me in that role of mother in the household. It meant taking on a lot of responsibility and being the first one to go through everything with military dad. My dad, you know, was really a very, like, the kind of the quintessential stereotype of the military guy. And my friends tended to be afraid of him. They didn't want to come over. The ones he liked, he would tease. And so they knew that they were in good with my dad if he was teasing them, because he is a joker. So some of them got to see that side of him. But those that didn't get to see that side of him saw a very serious, strict, you know, controlling father. And so they were all a little bit scared. And I think as far as boyfriends went, he wanted that. So we moved around. I mean, I was born in California. California is definitely home for me. We would leave California and come back. That happened a couple of times. We went to Georgia, came back to California, went to Maine, came back to California. So, you know, he avoided having to move internationally because, you know, we had a mother who was in Southern California and it was important to be near her. But it was very challenging. Let's put it this way. It was stressful growing up in a single parent home with a dad who was suddenly the only parent of 3 kids. We moved all over the United States and stayed connected to our mother. And so I took on a lot of responsibility as the oldest kid in the family.
Definitely. That sounds really tough. And within that structure, how did Amy Jo perceive the world?
Ooh, that's a good question. How did Amy Jo, little Amy Jo, perceive the world as, I would say probably a little bit as stressful. I think there was like a fair amount of stress in our family, but I also think my dad really did his best to hold it together, to support us in all that we did. I was very, very active in school, in athletics, in extracurricular things. And so, you know, and I got really good grades. I liked school. I think some of the really positive things I got from my dad was really learning to do my best at everything, really showing up as my best, really working hard. He's a very hard worker and taking pride in the things that I did. So I worked really hard, and he, you know, by example, he would show up, you know, it's like he was raising 3 kids by himself and he would still find ways to leave work early enough to get to my soccer game or make sure he was at the award ceremony and make sure he was at parent teacher night. I mean, he didn't miss anything. He really, really did his best to show up physically, even though he was fairly incapable of showing up emotionally, he really showed up in other ways that meant a lot for us. All of that had a very strong impact on me in terms of who I got to be in the world and how I wanted to be in the world. And as I got older and saw his emotional shortcomings or limitations, you know, I began to investigate that in ways that certainly diverged from him.
Yes. And I was actually going to ask you a little bit towards that. And how does your worldview has changed so far?
Yeah, we're pretty different. you can pretty much rest assured we never vote the same. It's interesting because everyone in my family is political to some degree. And my dad and I are both very political, and we couldn't be more opposite in terms of our political worldview. And yet we have a lot of respect and love for each other. My mother was in my life, and so I also had another influence there that I think was also helpful. She did show up more emotionally. She taught me about metaphysics. Through her and my stepfather, I learned about astrology when I was very young. I learned about psychic phenomena. I learned about metaphysics. They taught me to nurture my intuition. You know, I grew up Rosicrucian with them and then going to Methodist church with my dad. I was exposed to a lot of ideas at a really young age that a lot of people are not. And I was also taught to do that in secrecy. So there was a whole secrecy thing around it, because my dad thought the Rosicrucians were a cult, and that was kind of part of what broke up the marriage. And Rosicrucianism is not a cult. It's a sisterhood, brotherhood. It's not really a religion either. It's a system of thinking and a belief system. So I felt very fortunate to get exposed to really different ideas that taught me something about more of my internal strength and my internal ability, that it wasn't just about hard work and doing well on the outside, but it was really about being guided more internally. By my own compass and staying connected to spirit. I think my ideas about what that was evolved over my life through different, you know, exposure to different spiritual communities. But there was always a sense of spirit and being connected to something greater than myself that was, I think, really important for me.
Yes. And what do you think has led all these changes from your child's perspective, how you saw the world and how you are seeing it now?
In terms of sexuality specifically, which you asked about, you know, it was going through so many hard things. And, you know, growing up with my dad, having sex at a really young age before I was ready, my first sexual experiences were non-consensual. It took me a long time to be able to use the word rape. It wasn't a violent rape. It was a very confused, you know, problematic approach to sex with teenagers. So starting to have sexual relationships really young before I was ready, not knowing how to communicate, not knowing anything about my body, having pregnancy scares, not knowing how to orgasm as I got older and really became more interested in like, what's in this for me in terms of pleasure, really going on a path around that, not being able to do that and not being able to have the pleasure I wanted and really wanting to figure that out. It was all of those things. Being a queer kid that didn't know I was queer because I lived in such a heteronormative world. There were so many things. And then I did eventually have some unplanned pregnancies, two unplanned pregnancies, one in high school and one in college. It really was a lot of things on that journey around sexuality and coming to college and having sex education for the first time and realizing, oh my gosh, like this is what it's about. These are the answers to the questions I've had. You know, I didn't even know about birth control. I mean, I didn't know about anything because I went to three different high schools. I actually ended up living with my mother and my stepdad my last 2 years of high school. Going to three different high schools, I got zero sex education. So I was super unprepared for any of that. And, you know, and I was already having sex, you know, starting in junior high. I really was not getting the resources that I needed. I didn't have any parent that I could talk to about it. As open as my mom and my stepdad were in some ways, I really couldn't talk to my mom about sex. She was also a recovering Catholic. There was still a lot of that kind of like Sandra D approach to sex in our family. And she would kind of brag about that as if it was cute. And it actually ended up being shaming in many ways and not really helpful for opening the door. So my stepdad actually was the only person that really opened that door and told me, you know, if you ever think you're pregnant or there's anything going on with you, please talk to me. And that ended up being really important for me, that I did have that one adult that I was able to turn to when I needed that. So for me, it really was through sort of like that hard knock experience of, and I don't mean that, I don't mean that as a pun, but it came out that way. So yeah, having that experience in life that was so hard and painful in so many ways was really what drove me to wanting to first be empowered myself, seeking out mentors that I didn't even know I needed when I was younger. And once I found that, once I had that information, there was just no going back. And so as I was this young feminist in college, I went to UC Santa Barbara and I was very, very politically active. I really became politicized around reproductive justice. We didn't call it that then, but around reproductive justice issues, around sexual assault on campus and just women being powerful. And I was surrounded by all these amazing activists and did this underground work that was very radical. That really set this scene. And, you know, I would say that that introduction to activism at a very volatile time in terms of reproductive health, Rodney King was happening at that time. There were so many things bubbling to the surface, you know, that was like post-Reagan during Bush Senior's years. That politicization definitely, I would say, was one of the biggest things, along with my own education and my own path to empowerment.
Definitely. Who were your role models? I mean, you mentioned some of them, or how did you find them? As you say, so many things were bubbling up at that time, but it was just like casually just finding and bumping and something resonated with you and you kind of leaned onto that perspective, or how were you finding mentors?
You know, I have always had mentors, and I've talked to friends who said, man, I've never had a mentor, like, you know, who've asked me similar questions, because I've had a lot of mentors in the mentorship in my life. And I think, I think it's a combination of things. I think one was that I really sought it out. I showed up when I was in college. I was in radio. As soon as I hit college campus, I knew I wanted to do radio, and I immediately got involved with the radio station. And for 4.5 years, that was my jam. I did, everything was about the radio station, and I held a lot of leadership positions there. And a wonderful woman, Elizabeth Robinson, came to the radio station as advisor in my sophomore year. And I became very close with her. Having a woman in a leadership role at the station like that, that was really, really powerful for me. And she came out of Berkeley in the 60s, and her partner taught Black Studies at UCSB and was a very well-known professor in Black Studies and author. So, you know, they were pretty amazing in and of their own right. I had access to someone like that, which was really important. And then my teachers, you know, and I think it's interesting you're asking about this, because I've been in conversation about this with another group that I'm a part of right now, where I'm working on leadership things. I was always favored by teachers, and I was favored by teachers, you know, or mentors. And that allowed me to have a deeper relationship with them. And I was favored by them, not just because, you know, of something random. I think I was favored because I showed up so fully. I really would show up with my whole heart. I would work hard. They saw me working hard. They saw a lot of potential in me, and they wanted to pull that out of me. And so I my soul surrounded myself with people like that, that would do that, that would stand for me, that would pull the best out of me, that would challenge me. And I think also who respected me. And so there's a lot of mutual respect. And, you know, as someone who's a teacher, I'm now on the other side of that. And I get that, you know, there is such a synergy that gets to happen between teachers and students, mentors and mentees. And I really had that in so many parts of my life. I had that in spiritual communities. I had that in school, going all the way to grade school. I can think of cases where I had special things with teachers. And certainly, you know, in business, a lot of the mentors I've also had in business and in other parts of life. So I think that I have sought it out, and I'm very careful about who I choose to mentor me. You know, I have to feel aligned with people that I'm going to take on that relationship with, as, you know, if I'm going to learn from them and they don't like support the empowerment of women, like that's not ever going to work. So, you know, I think it's also really choosing people really carefully, but I was just that person that I was going to show up. So they could embrace it. They could send me away, I suppose, but they didn't, you know. And I think it was the way that I showed up, that I was hungry to learn and wanted that mentorship and wanted that mentor mentee relationship. And so I did really create that with a lot of people in my life. And I don't take it for granted at all. I really don't.
What I see is that you had, and you mentioned it at the beginning, that you had this role from your father of always showing up. And that it's clearly something that put you in that path. But would you associate or equal showing up to believing in yourself? Do you think it's that the same or not?
You know, it's an interesting question because I can look at my family, and me and my sisters came out of our upbringing very differently. I came out with a lot of strength, a lot of belief in myself, a lot of confidence. I've always believed in myself. I've always believed in my capability to do whatever I was going to set out to do in the world. I've never worried about money. I've never been super focused on that when I was younger. Then as I got older, I got more focused on that and I wanted to figure that piece out. It really always was about mission and vision and being my best self. And I always had the confidence to know I could do that. One of my younger sisters, she really came out of that upbringing with my father with a very battered self-esteem. And so I think it's an interesting question and it's an interesting thing to look at how we came out of the same family, but because we played really different roles in the family, and maybe she was sensitive to things I wasn't, maybe my father said things to her he didn't say to me. I think I blew off some of the BS that came from him. You know, he has like a way of joking that's not really funny. You know, and it took me until I got into adulthood and I had a partner one time that said, oh, no, we don't joke like that, where I realized it. I didn't realize it because that's just how my dad joked. And he jokes with people by picking on them. And so I didn't internalize that. I knew he was joking. I didn't really take it on. My sister really did. We had a very different experience, even though we grew up with that same hardworking dad, that same example. I did a little bit better in school than she did, although she mostly did really well. You know, I think that those roles that we play in the family, they really do make a difference, because it's so fascinating to me that she and I came out really differently in terms of that piece of our psyche and who we are. She's done very well for herself in life. You know, she's certainly worked on herself, and I can see very big differences, you know, and I think some of that is innate. Some of that is just that we're really different people. And I do think that some of it is the roles that we played in our family.
Yes, I hear you. And my experience is the same. We are three and I'm the oldest. And yeah, it's like we were under the same circumstances, apparently. And the three of us have like diametrically different thinking approaches and everything. Considering that, like believing in yourself is a conscious process? Because I hear you, for example, in about showing up, and it's something that I am actually working on really hard in my life now, you know, about like showing off and being there. I feel that I'm a confident woman in some areas of my life, and in some areas I'm just like, you know, sexuality has been one of them that I've been gaining confidence as long as I've been working with you. But in general, I'm pushing myself to show up in things, but even that, even with that, and even with the confidence and things, it's like I have found that believing in the things that you're doing, it's a key component into showing up. Otherwise, it's really hard to show up. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So the question is around, where do I think that belief in myself comes from?
Or if it was a process that it was taught to you or you learn it. Yeah. Because I believe that if you believe in yourself, you will show up fully.
Yeah. So I think beliefs are really complicated, right? Because they come from a lot of places. We are not born with any beliefs. We are a blank slate when we come into this world. You know, and we could go into a deeper conversation about, well, what world were we in before and have we lived before and all of that. But, you know, we really are a blank slate in terms of our belief system when we come into this world. We learn it. All of it is learned. The people that are around you and the examples that are set for you are critically important, and certainly in those early years. And I think that also could be part of why my sister and I did have a different experience, right? Because we know that the subconscious mind is developed between the ages of 0 and 7. And it's around the age of 7 that kind of the cap comes on to the subconscious mind and the conscious mind comes online, where we're then able to reason and we don't just accept everything that has come to us. So I think given that I was around the age of 6 or 7, I was right around that age when my mother left, I had something maybe that was more intact, whereas my siblings were younger. And so they were still very, very impressionable and they were still taking in whatever was in that environment at that time. And so my father being very stressed, suddenly he's raising 3 kids. I mean, this happened suddenly for him. He did not know that was about to happen. I don't remember a lot of specifics of that, but I'm sure we felt it. I'm sure we felt his pain. I'm sure we felt his sadness. We certainly experienced his anger. I think that was his outward expression. And because of course, men have more permission for that. So I think it is an interesting thing to consider, like, where do those beliefs happen? They come from so many places. They certainly come from your family of origin. They come from your parents. They also come from, you know, all the people you're surrounded with. And so like you and I were talking earlier about education and the educational system. I mean, when your kids spend 6 or 8 hours a day at school, whatever is in that environment is impacting them more than pretty much anything, because they're spending the most time in that environment. Going to good schools or having teachers that really know how to teach, that really know how to lift up their students and inspire them, that have their own self-esteem so that they can really lift up the self-esteem of their students. I think that is so deeply, deeply important, you know? And I think me having those relationships I had with teachers all along the way, you know, there's no way that wasn't a part of me learning to believe in myself. I did well in school, so I got rewarded for my work, and then that got reinforced, and then the expectation that I was going to get those grades would then follow, right? And I think at the same time, that would happen for someone that's not doing well in school. Then a lot of times what can happen is the expectation is like, oh yeah, you're a slacker, you're not going to do the work, you're not capable, you're dumb, I don't even expect that you're going to do well on the test. I mean, I'm sure there were probably students in many of the same classrooms that I was in who may have had that experience because they weren't performing and then they got that reinforced. And so having teachers that don't actually reinforce failure or what is perceived as failure, or who don't reinforce that belief that I can't do it, or I'm not going to be as smart as my older sister or my older brother or whatever, you know, there's a lot of those dynamics too when kids are in the same school from the same family. I mean, I think all beliefs are learned. And I think it is really important to look at, well, who's affecting our belief system? Who are we surrounding ourselves with? And who are our kids being surrounded with?
Oh, yes, for sure. What are the beliefs that you think help you create the world that you live in now?
Oh my God, so many. You know, I was thinking about this before our interview today. I mean, I think number one is that women are powerful and that women have been kept down because men historically have been afraid of our power. I would say that's a very big belief of mine. I don't give that piece a lot of energy. I just support the women are powerful part. But I do believe, you know, like there are structures that are in place that have really kept women down, that have kept people of color down, that have created inequalities that are very dramatic in our world. And so I'm always looking through a lens of power. Who has political power? Who has voice? Who has access to resources, whether it's money or other resources, right? That is so important to everything that I do and to my mission in the world. And for me, it really didn't matter how I was going to walk through that door with women. It just was that I knew I wanted to walk through those doors. And then it hit me that I wanted to do it through that lens of sexuality. And so I have a whole belief system around sexuality that has really allowed me to support women in this core part of their lives that I feel is a place where we are often most disempowered. I think we get most disempowered generally around sex and around money. And so those have been two really big pieces of my work. And so my belief that sexuality is absolutely core to who we are is also a critical belief. I would say those are two of the really big ones. And so my whole career, my whole business my whole approach in my work has been really based off of those beliefs. And what is it going to take to lift women out of this? And it's one by one by one, you know, and I've gotten to do that. You know, it's just the greatest gift of my life. All the women, I mean, I can just, their faces are flashing through my mind as I'm saying this, you know, over all these years that have come through this work with me and gone on to do whatever they went on to do, because there was a different sense of knowing of themselves. There was a different sense of confidence. There was a different sense of their own empowerment and their own ability to get their needs met, to express themselves, to feel pleasure, to love their bodies and be in their bodies. I mean, all of that is so, so important to then how we show up in everything else. I really believe that that starting there at that core, very tender place of sexuality, it impacts everything else. It's a pretty strong belief system, and it's why I have stayed on this path for 25 years. Literally, I have not wavered from my mission to help people with this part of their lives. And I've helped people of all genders. I taught college for many years. I was a trainer for many years. I've worked with nonprofits in New York, and you know, I've done it through a lot of different doorways. And the mission and the vision for what I knew I was doing, I've not wavered from that. That it's looked lots of different ways, but I've not wavered from that core place. It's directly related to these beliefs. So thank you for the question. You got me thinking about it before we came on today's call. Let me think about this. What really is most important to who I am and the world I've created?
I hear you, and I can tell, you know, it's very consistent, and it's something that you transmit. Clearly, you live that belief system, and that's how you can offer it. Regarding that, I would ask you, how would you say to people that they can change their beliefs?
I mean, we all have work to do on that. You know, I'm constantly working on myself on that. Part of it is we have to learn how to talk to that subconscious mind that took on something that we get to let go of. And so whether it's feeling like we were not desirable, feeling like we weren't good enough, feeling like we weren't lovable, feeling like everybody was going to leave us, you know, I mean, we those beliefs go way, way back to when we're very little. And many of us could pinpoint a moment where somebody said something to us, and that's all it took, right? Because we're so impressionable, you know, you're ugly. You know, you're never going to amount to anything, you know, oh, you got crappy grades again, of course, right? Or the flip side of that. And so I know that part of my well-being and my confidence came from that I got the flip side of that a lot. Even if I was getting a lot of like anger and challenges with my dad, I still was getting lifted up by teachers, by my mom. I did get lifted up by my dad as well. And so whatever those things are we've taken on, we get to, I think a piece of it is we get to go back and we get to heal that child. We get to heal that moment so that we can really release it. We have to be aware that we even are carrying the belief. I think a lot of times we're not aware we're even carrying it. So it's really identifying that we're carrying it, where it came from, healing it, and really replacing it with a new belief. What's the new belief, you know? And sometimes you don't have to even do all that. Sometimes you can just bypass a lot of that. And it's the, you know, the realization comes in, oh my God, I've been thinking this all these years and that's complete bullshit. I'm not going to believe that anymore. You know, for me, one of those big moments was around money and livelihood, because I had learned from so many people in my life that the path I had chosen, I could never make money with. I literally had a therapist tell me that in my session with her once. Well, oh yeah. I mean, you know, because we were talking about money in my relationship and my partner made a lot more money than I did. So we were dealing with some things around money. And she said, well, I mean, you chose a path where you weren't going to make money. I mean, you knew that. And I said, what? Is that what I chose? Did I choose that? I don't remember choosing that. You know, I chose the thing that I cared about and that I knew I was here to do. So it's been a lot of years. You know, I won't even say that I'm totally through that. I mean, it's, you know, I think those kinds of things can get so ingrained in us. You know, I had sexuality mentors tell me, oh, honey, you're never going to make money as a sex educator. That's not why we do this. I mean, literally my mentors told me that. So as much as I had these wonderful mentors, I did also have a lot of mentors who had a lot of challenges with money. And when I looked at who they were all women. And so I actually at that point started to seek out other mentors. I realized I'm not going to learn this money piece from them, you know, and I sought out a male mentor around money because I felt I needed a very different energy and a very different approach around that. So that was very, very important for me to break through this. And of course, it's not true. It's ridiculous. It's, you know, and I got that from a lot of places. I got that from activist communities. I got that from, you know, where it's like, you're not down with the cause if you're actually making money. And it's like, no, I actually get to do good in the world and help people. And I actually get to be paid for that. So I think there's a lot in activist communities. And I also think in spiritual communities. I got that a lot in spiritual communities. So I think we can all look at our lives and where are the places where we've taken on belief systems that just are not supportive of where we want to go. And so I've left communities because of that. I've left spiritual communities. I have distanced myself from mentors who, you know, I felt like, you know, I got what I needed to get here. We went as far as we needed to go and I'm moving on. I've chosen much more carefully how I do activism and who I surround myself with because there's so much scarcity in activist communities. I think that what I do in the world is activism and activism gets to look a lot of different ways. So, you know, I think sometimes it does mean saying goodbye to those people in our lives that don't actually support us to go where we're going. And that one's hard for people. Sometimes that's really hard.
Thank you. Yeah, that is hard. It implies a lot of change. And that might seem like a hard work to do or a hard or sometimes an impossible way to go. So as a sexuality expert, how would you envision the world?
Oh, my goodness. I would envision a lot more women leaders and out LGBTQ leaders, a lot more people of color in leadership positions, first of all. You know, I do think that leadership really matters and the perspective of our leaders matters. Having a bunch of white men who have access to money and resources who are completely out of touch with anyone that's had a different experience in the world, that's going to give you a particular outcomes. And I think we're seeing that right now, you know, and we're seeing the friction that's now happening because all of these women of color are coming into Congress. And it's just, it's amazing to watch and to see them rise up. And then also, you know, they get a lot of pushback just for being who they are, never mind what their political stance is. So, you know, for me, it definitely would mean women and people of color and queer people who have other perspectives and other analyses, really looking at our systems and what would it mean to reorganize some of the systems that are not working. I mean, most of our systems are not working. I think we're seeing that right now, right? I mean, we're sheltering in place right now. We're seeing the limitations of our financial system. We're seeing the limitations of our school system. We're seeing the limitations of healthcare. We're seeing the limitations of our political system. And so I don't know what's going to come out of this, but I think we get to take a really hard look at the systems because we all exist in a context. So we exist in that system. So I think that's kind of the macro. And then on the micro, it's that every child has sex education that is healthy, that is sex positive, that is nourishing, that is truthful, that is vulnerable, that answers their questions, that you know, and that really was what drove me into sex ed to begin with. I wanted to work with young people, and I did for the first 12 years of my career. I primarily worked with young people because I wanted to help other kids not go through what I did. So, I mean, I really think it starts there. I will always be an advocate for comprehensive sexuality education for children. It should start in pre-K. I've worked in programs where we started in pre-K, you know, and I think when people hear that, they think, oh my God, what? You know, like as if we're, you know, talking about sexual positions to kindergartners or something, you know. I mean, it's just like math, you know, with little kids, you're teaching them their numbers. And then you start to teach them addition and subtraction. And then they learn to multiply and then, you know, and so forth until they're doing algebra and calculus. It's the same thing with sex ed. There are things that we can be teaching children at every age. And if we all had that, man, would this world look different. I mean, that alone, what that would do for this world would be enormous. Because implicit in comprehensive sexuality education is that we are addressing gender issues. We are addressing bias. We are addressing abuse. We are, you know, we are teaching them how to communicate their limitations and their wants and consent. And I mean, all of that would be a part of their education. Can you imagine if kids had that across the board, what that would be like to come out as a senior into college and into the world? Like how much more resourced they would be and able to stand for themselves, to have a thrilling, exciting, pleasurable, fun, consensual, healthy sexual life, whatever they chose that that was going to be, whether it's with themselves or with other people, that nobody would be telling them it had to look a certain way and they would have the tools they would need. That would change everything. So it would start there.
Ahoy. Yeah. I want to live in that world too.
I know, right?
Yeah.
I didn't get it. That's for sure.
I know. Me neither. And that's what I'm trying to generate in my house with my son, you know, like, and also see that as normal and have names for things, which for me was my biggest challenge. I couldn't tell things by its name because I didn't know what they were. Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. That makes a huge difference and it's a good starting point.
Yeah. And again, all the other parts of life that would be impacted, you know, because if we know how to negotiate the most tender things, you know, what I'm going to do with my body, how I'm going to share it, or if I'm going to share it, if we know how to negotiate that, going in to ask for a raise is going to be so much easier, you know, negotiating things at work. I mean, we negotiate things every day in our lives. And so standing for ourselves and negotiating in a way that is healthy and is going to get our needs met and make sure that we're not being taken advantage of or manipulated. I mean, that impacts everything. Teaching young people and really role playing with them so that they can learn how to have those really healthy and nuanced conversations. Man, that would just be everything.
And I think it goes deeper because the oppression that causes, I mean, the way they are now, it causes a lot of oppression that generates violence. And look at the world. We could avoid all that.
I'll tell you another belief that I have is that all violence in the world relates back to gender roles. You can relate every kind of violence in the world. If you just think of all the different examples, whether it's intimate partner violence, whether it's rape, whether it is wartime violence and what happens in war, it goes back to what it means to be a man. It goes back to men dominating women. It goes back to women taking care of men's needs. I mean, all of it can be linked back to gender roles. And so if we taught kids to be very critical about gender roles and to create different kinds of gender roles for themselves and different roles in the way that they set up their relationships and that there's negotiating room for that and that we're not just making assumptions about girls are going to do this and boys are going to do that. And then what about all the rest of us as well? We would not live in the violent world that we live in because it all relates back to that.
Totally. And what would you think if we didn't have the condition that we have had, how would that would look like?
If the things that I'm saying we need, if we had all of that?
Yeah.
I think we would really understand what equity meant. I think we would be playing on a team rather than playing against each other. I think that everyone's needs would get met. I mean, we've shown in this time that we actually do have the resources to meet people's needs. We just don't. We just don't feed everybody. We just don't give healthcare to everybody. Everybody would be able to have that. There would be no leaving people behind. There would be no winners and losers. I think that our world, it would be a complete 180. You know, the ways that capitalism has really exploited people, that would shift. That wouldn't be the game that we would be choosing to play. And I would love to see that world in my lifetime. You know, I do think something is going to come out of this, you know, and I don't know what it's going to look like because, of course, there are plenty of factions that don't want to see that world. I mean, they're already complaining about, oh, we can't just be giving welfare benefits to everybody. And it's like, why not?
Exactly. Yeah. For me, it's very interesting because at the end, it's all made up. I mean, it's human made. So it's like, why not? I hear you. I wish I could see that too. I'm a firm believer that things would change and, you know, that the world will transform sooner than we think.
Yeah, I think, you know, we get to make sure that it does.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So I want to ask you, what is one of your key beliefs that has shaped your life?
I guess the biggest, I would say, that is that love exists and that I'm loved. You know, because I've felt it in different ways and I have doubted in many other ways from certain people. But I think love has made me kept going. Mm-hmm. Sometimes have been misunderstood, you know, like, for example, like, this is a very simple, but to put it, my mother gave me love through giving me sweet things. So when I would feel anxious, I would just need that craving of sweet. And it took me a while to recognize that, oh, it's just because, you know, love was associated with those things. Finally was able to just don't go and craving and eat like desperately cookies, you know, because I found out what it was. But in many ways, also, that was what kept me going. The belief that love exists and that I have felt it.
That love exists or that you get to have it? That everyone gets to have it.
I guess the one that like really have kept me going is that love exists.
Yeah.
But I haven't felt always that I either deserve it or like, mm-hmm. you know, I was worth of it or whose love what I was worth of, you know, that has been a process that I have been working with.
Yeah. I mean, it really does come back to those core things, you know, am I lovable? Am I worthy? Am I enough? You know, we've all got wounds in those places. As we get older, I think we get complicated and then it really does simplify, you know, because when we really get to the core of what it is, it's like, yeah, the core is love.
Yeah. And my point is now is why do we have to go through that curve and not just start, you know, I mean, I know that it's a learning process, but I'm also now a firm believer that we can learn in other ways. You don't have to learn in the hard, like suffering and sacrificing.
Well, I think we all learn through challenge, right? Like everyone is going to be challenged in their life, but we certainly could be teaching children a different framework for how they see challenges.
Exactly. But for me, when I was growing up, it was just like sacrificing and suffering. You know, it was painful actually to show up or trying to be myself and break the mold where I was or where I grew up. It was painful.
Yeah.
And it was the double pain of like doing things differently from where your family or all the people around you and the pain of going through a new thing. And so it was really painful. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you one more thing. If I could give you a permission slip, what would you give yourself permission to do?
Ooh, you're turning it on me. I give people permission slips in my work. I love it. I'm trying to think what do I keep myself from doing? Like what is it I don't give myself permission for? I would probably say money and like how I spend money on myself. It would probably be like doing something really just lavish, traveling somewhere exotic and being as lavish as I could with it. Or I think it would be something very luxurious and opulent. Like I do allow myself luxuries, but yeah, I think with full permission, it would be, yeah, go for it. And just do something really, really opulent. Yeah.
Okay. Permission granted then.
Yay. What would you do with your permission slip, Aurora?
Oh, I will just start walking around the world with my flags. Yeah.
We need that.
I would love to. Yeah.
Nice. Thank you so much. I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for the questions. It's nice to be asked really different questions. So I appreciate it.
Thank you. I just want to acknowledge you for all the work that you have been doing. I am one of those that have benefited of it. I'm so grateful that when I found you, you have helped me to really seeing things differently and giving me words to name things. It has opened my life in so many different ways and has given me tools to really work with the things that come up. And I'm really, really grateful for that.
Oh, thank you so much for that. And what a delight to do this with you. So thanks for having me.
Where would you like to send people if they want to learn more about your work?
Anyone that wants to follow my work, really amyjogoddard.com is the hub. You can find me on Facebook pretty easily. I'm Amy Jo Goddard on Twitter, and I am Sexual Empowerment on Instagram.
Thank you so much, Amy Jo.
Thanks, Aurora.
Ciao for now, and meanwhile, you are invited to envision and take action. What can you do today to create the world that you want to live in?